Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
Thanks to the organizers for inviting me to come here and give you an update on what we have been doing on northern white rhino stem cells for the last several years. So I work at the Beckman Center for Conservation Research, and I always like to point out that the zoo does have a large conservation research area that spans multiple different disciplines all around the world, where we study everything from genetics and induced pluripotent stem cells to translocations and reintroductions, as well as community engagement. So for any undergrads out there, we do have a 12-week summer fellowship program that you can come and be mentored by a researcher at the Beckman Center, which is a great opportunity. And I always have to start out and recognize my stem cell team, that without them, I would not be able to do any of the research that I'm going to tell you about today. So Gwen and Vanessa are the ones that are there every weekend taking care of the stem cells, because, you know, they're very needy. They need to be babysat every single day. So thank you to them for making all of this possible. So why are we talking about stem cells for conservation? Well, we're in an extinction crisis. So we have been destroying our habitat, we are causing global warming, we are overpopulated, and we are overharvesting different species. So we need to start thinking about new methods to save these species. And I found this quote in a paper that I was reading. The extinction rate is changing the trajectory of evolution globally and destroying the conditions that make human life possible. So even if we don't actually care about the species that we're trying to conserve, we need to do it for ourselves. We need to save our planet for our future and for our children and grandchildren's future. So traditional conservation methods, we have things like habitat management, captive breeding, species monitoring, and reproduction. So this, we have been working on this to try and stem the space of the extinction crisis. But that's not always enough to bring back the biodiversity that we need. So in 2023, Revive and Restore brought together a group of stem cell scientists from multiple different disciplines. And we had discussion panels and brainstormed everything that we could use stem cells for conservation. And this paper here was the outcome of that workshop that we had. And we're focused on the, you know, using gametes, biobanking tissues, and then using those materials for induced pluripotent stem cells that we can then use for in vitro gametogenesis, disease modeling, and other research to help us save the species. So all of my work for the last several years has been focused on the northern white rhino. And why are we focused on rhinos? Well, all rhinos are endangered. There's five species. They are all decreasing in numbers. And we've been focused specifically on the northern white rhino because there's only two remaining. So there's two females, non-reproductive, mother-daughter pair. And why have we focused on rhinos? You know, they are all endangered, but they're also very charismatic. So we can bring our conservation story to the people by using an organism like the rhino. And we are losing over 1,000 rhinos every year, especially the southern whites, due to poaching. So all rhinos are under armed guard. All of the preserves are patrolled to prevent poachers, but they still go in and kill the rhinos to remove their horn. And they remove the horn because in traditional medicine, it's erroneously believed to have medicinal purposes and to be an aphrodisiac. It's also a status symbol, so people will like to have dagger handles made out of rhino horn. Rhino horn is keratin. It is the same thing as your fingernails. So you can go out, you don't need to go out and buy rhino horn for over $300,000 a rhino horn. You can just chew on your fingernails. It's the same effect. So we really need to get that education out there to prevent the poaching crisis with the northern white rhinos and the southern white rhinos and all of them. So I just want to introduce you to the two females that are remaining. It's Fatu and Nayin, her mother. So they live on a preserve in Kenya called Old Pejeta. And they are the last remaining two of the subspecies. So they have been the subject of a lot of research in the last few years. So myself and several colleagues across the world have come up with this genetic rescue toolbox, or like a roadmap for how we can apply genetic rescue to the northern white rhino. So again, we have only two. So for Fatu, who still has oocytes. We can do some assisted reproductive techniques, but you know, overall, we will not be able to ever have abundance of embryos for the northern white rhino. So we're reliant on biobanking. We're reliant on advanced cellular techniques. We're reliant on using southern white rhinos as a reproductive model, and hopefully putting all of this together with advanced reproductive techniques. So what do I mean by all of these things? Biobanking, we're preserving living genetic material. So this is in cell lines, like fibroblast cell lines, which are skin cells, or reproductive material. And much of the stuff that is biobanked right now may contain more genetic diversity than what is present in the current population. We have our advanced cellular technologies, which includes our induced pluripotent stem cells, in vitro gametogenesis, in vitro embryo modeling, somatic cell nuclear transfer, or cloning, and gene editing. So the southern white rhino, closely related subspecies, they're only about 80,000 years diverged from the northern white rhino, so we can use them as a reproductive model that we can then understand all of rhino reproduction, we can understand hormones, we can use hormone induction to do oocyte collection. And with those oocyte collections, we have our advanced reproduction techniques where we can take those oocytes, we can do intracytoplasmic sperm injection, and then create an embryo in the lab that can then be matured and transferred to a surrogate, which would be our southern white rhino model. And then hopefully, if all of these pieces come together, which there's a lot of smaller pieces that fit into this, then we will hopefully have a future population of northern white rhinos that we can then reintroduce. But in that case, we need to think about, you know, what are the ethics of actually trying to reintroduce this species? And do we have the capabilities to care for the species as we are generating the population and then the habitat to reintroduce it? So do we still have areas in Africa that we could safely put these rhinos back in? So we have to think about all of these things as we are putting this roadmap together. So today, this is a stem cell seminar series. We're going to focus on the advanced cellular technologies. So we're going to focus on induced pluripotent stem cells in rhino. We're going to focus on in vitro gametogenesis, so turning those stem cells into sperm and egg, and some in vitro embryo modeling, where we can actually examine embryo development in the lab. So this has been a very, very bumpy road that I've spent a lot of time working on in the last several years. And so we're going to take a deep dive into just those advanced cellular techniques. So here's a little bit more detail of what we're going to talk about for the rest of today. So fibroblasts, so we have that biobanking. We need to have material that we can use. We need to have genomics. So endangered species, you don't always have reference genomes. You don't always have that genetic material available. Anyone in the audience who works on human and mouse, you can go to NCBI and get more information about your species, you know, a gene of interest, then you know what to do with. We do not have that option. So we need to build those tools for ourselves. We then need to be able to make induced pluripotent stem cells from those biobanked fibroblasts. We need to check and see if they can differentiate. Can they differentiate into the three germ layers of the developing embryo? Can they differentiate into primordial germ cells? So these are the precursors to the gametes. So these develop early in the embryo, migrate to the gonadal ridge, and develop into the sperm and the egg. And if we can tell our stem cells to become primordial germ cells, can they then mature into those functional gametes so we can make an embryo? So we're going to start with the biobanking. We do have our frozen zoo at the Beckman Center for Conservation Research. It was founded in 1975. We're actually celebrating our 50th anniversary next month. And Dr. Kurt Banerjka and Arlene Kumamoto started it. It is now curated by Marlis Hauck and the Reproductive Sciences team. So this is a vast resource of fibroblast cell lines and reproductive material, including gametes, reproductive tissue. And we have over 11,000 individuals represented in fibroblast cell lines and 1,300 species and subspecies represented. So it's a very great resource of living genetic material for the future. And fortunately for us, we have 12 northern white rhino fibroblast cell lines in the frozen zoo. So these have been cryopreserved over the last 40 years. The oldest cell line that I'm working with is from 1979, so a little bit more than 40. And we have this resource that is then quality controlled with karyotyping. So this is a metaphase spread over here to confirm the number of chromosomes, that it's a normal cell line, and that we can then use that for additional research. So we have our fibroblast cell lines. We have those 12 lines banked. It's not very many, but it's more than most anywhere else has. So we wanted to move on to our genomics. So as I mentioned, we do not have the resources that are available for mouse and human, so we wanted to build a reference genome. But the first question everybody always asks me, 12 cell lines, how can that possibly be enough to bring back a species from the brink of extinction and have a healthy population? So we wanted to examine the genetic diversity of those cell lines before we actually took a deep dive into the rest of this project. So we had Dr. Tate Tunstall, was a postdoc in our lab several years ago, and he sequenced 9 northern white rhino fibroblast cell lines and 4 southern white rhino cell lines. And this PCA here, the northern whites are in red, and the southern whites are in green. So you can see that they separate into 2 distinct populations on the x-axis. And then you can see on the y-axis that we have a lot of more diversity or a bigger spread within those cell lines there. So that is telling us that those have more genetic diversity than the southern whites. And I told you we sequenced 4 southern white individuals. I swear there are 4 dots there. They are just so similar that they fall on top of each other. So there's very little diversity within those southern whites. So we actually have more genetic diversity captured in the 12 fibroblast cell lines of the northern white rhino than we do in all of the ones that we have from southern whites. To put that into perspective, the southern white and the northern white both have more genetic diversity than several other endangered species, and including humans. We're not endangered, but so we do have quite a bit of genetic material to work with. So we're pretty confident that we will be able to use these cell lines to effectively bring back a healthy population. And my colleague, Dr. Erin Wilder, has taken that a step further, and she wanted to look at the number of non-synonymous mutations that were present in the genomes. And so if it is in a coding region and it has a non-synonymous change, that means it can change the function. Those are potentially harmful mutations. So the northern white rhino does carry more of these potential mutations. However, they also have that extra genetic diversity, so that's where it's coming from. Where the southern white rhino has less, so they've had a chance to purge some of that. However, the northern white rhino has lower of these SNP, these potentially harmful mutations, in the homozygous state. So they're not going to be expressed, where the southern white rhino has more of them in the homozygous state. So this population has rebounded from a bottleneck to come back to a healthy population of about 17,000 individuals. So we can use this level as a benchmark to keep our northern white rhino population below in order to bring back a healthy population. So we have our genetic diversity, so we're going to go ahead and move forward with the rest of this project. So we found out the hard way. We kind of took a deep dive and realized we really, really need this reference genome because we were struggling trying to use every resource out there that did not have all of the information that we needed. So we built a large collaboration and had a graduate student that has now finished his PhD that did all of our bioinformatic analysis. So we used a hybrid approach for genome assembly. We did Hi-C, bionano optical mapping, 10x linked reads, and Oxford nanopore sequencing, and we merged all of these technologies together to generate a high-quality reference genome. And we used Angelifu, who was a male northern white rhino that lived at the safari park until 2014, when he passed away from old age. And what I want to point out is that rhinos have a 2N of 82, so they have a lot of chromosomes and a lot that are very small, so it's a little bit more difficult to assemble this genome. And here's a diagram that outlines what our reference genome looks like. So we were able to assemble our genome into chromosome level. So we have all 40 autosomes, so the chromosomes represented, and then the X for the sex chromosome. We have the gaps are indicated by black. And on some of these scaffolds, we actually have sequenced telomere and centromere sequence so that we have basically a telomere to telomere genome assembly on some of these chromosomes. So this was really exciting for us. But we wanted to take it a step further, and we wanted to actually make sure that we were anchoring every one of those scaffolds to the correct chromosome. So Marlis, the curator of the frozen zoo, was actually hired in the 80s to figure out how to grow rhino fibroblast cells and to figure out what their karyotype was, because nobody could agree on the number of chromosomes that rhinos had. So she karyotyped all the species of rhinos and made an ideogram, or a banding map, if you will, of their chromosomes. So this is the ideogram of all of the rhinos that are 2N of 82, which is all rhinos except for black rhinos. And she collaborated with Dr. Terry Lear, who was part of the Horse Genome Assembly project. And they were looking at genes from the horse genome mapped across all of the species of rhinos. So they were looking for genome conservation between rhinos and then also with horse, which is our closest relative to rhinos that is a model system. And so on this image here, we have our horse chromosomes on the left and our rhino chromosomes on the right. So they were able to anchor most of that ideogram that Marlis designed to the physical chromosomes and then also correlate it with the horse genome. So they mapped about 73 of these genes to the rhino genome. We took it a step further, and we took the entire horse genome and our brand new rhino genome, and we aligned them to each other. So here, horse is in blue and yellow, and rhino is in gray and white. And you can see that there's a very high conservation of the gene content between these chromosomes. And what is really cool is that for almost every chromosome, it's either a one-to-one comparison, or you have one rhino chromosome equals a chromosome arm in the horse. So there is a lot of conservation between the gene content between the two species and the order and arrangement of it. And so one of the things I like to point out is that here on our scaffold 5 or chromosome 5 in rhino, you can see that there looks like there's like a huge rearrangement and difference between the horse and the rhino. Well, we looked at those a little bit closer. There were a few places where we found that. And you do see that here's our assembly. This gene here, rho, is down near the bottom. But if you look at the actual fish mapping data, you can see that this is supposed to be above this gene here. So this is actually an area of where our genome assembly was wrong. So there were gaps within the assembly in these regions, and the pieces had been put together upside down. So we were able to go back in and fix these regions. So this was kind of like our ground truth of our data. So hopefully I've convinced you that we have enough fibroblasts in the frozen zoo to actually go forward with this project. We have our genomics, we have our genetic diversity, we have our reference genome. So now it's time to start talking about induced pluripotent stem cells. So that's going to be our advanced cellular technologies that we're going to go forward with. And so this is what I've been focused on for much of my career with this rhino project. So we knew in 2011 that we could actually make induced pluripotent stem cells from endangered species, but my colleagues that had done that reprogramming used a lentiviral vector, which lentivirus integrates into the genome of the host cells to do the reprogramming. If we're trying to use these cells for conservation, we do not want to be introducing any other genomic material into our cell lines. So we set about to look for other methods to do this reprogramming. And we found that the Sendai virus, which is a mouse respiratory virus, we were able to use that carrying the human transcription factors to reprogram rhino fibroblasts. So the first time we did this reprogramming, we were able to reprogram Angelifu and get one clone. So human reprogramming, it's about 0.01% efficient. Rhino, it's 10 to 100 times less efficient. So it was taking us a very long time to generate these stem cells. So we set about to try and figure out where we could optimize this process throughout every step of the way. So this is going to be a very busy slide. I don't expect you to follow all of it. I just want to emphasize how many different things we had to test as we went along through our about 5 different reprogramming experiments that we've done. So this timeline is taken from the Sendai reprogramming manual. So we buy it from Thermo Fisher. We did initially make a few changes. So This here is where we are treating ourselves as fibroblasts. So again, Marlis was hired to figure out how to grow rhinofibroblasts. She worked with a company to develop media that actually supported rhinofibroblasts. So we changed out the protocol to include our rhinofibroblast media. And then we also included that in our stem cell media that we developed. And we call that KB media in honor of Dr. Kurt Banerjska, who's founded the Frozen Zoo. So when we did our initial reprogramming, trying to test everything, we had to test the number of cells that we started with. The Sendai is not very cytotoxic to rhinos, so we had a lot of issues with the cells overgrowing and not getting enough virus. So we tested about 4 different seeding densities. We had to test the amount of virus that we applied to the cells. That first experiment we did, we tried 3 different combinations of that. And then as the process progresses, we were having a lot of issues with, again, the cells were not very cytotoxic to the Sendai, so our cells were overgrowing the plates and peeling and dying off before we actually had a time to fulfill the process. So we were monitoring and changing the time frames where we would then replate the cells. And the timing changes depending on the species that we're working on. In rhinos, it takes about 2 weeks to a month to actually have colonies that are capable of being selected and moved out to another plate, and those will become our new stem cell clones. So we've actually gone past that time now, and I'll tell you about that later. So when we did this, we actually got a few more clones. So we found a number of cells, the concentration of the virus, that worked pretty well. But it still wasn't all that efficient. So then we did several more experiments where we started testing different small molecules that we could add to the media while we were doing the process and different time frames for when we could do it. So at that point where we replate the cells on or earlier on in the process. And these are epigenetic modulators to help open up the chromatin so that those transcription factors can help or be more easily bound to the DNA. So multiple experiments later, we've tested all of these at these different time frames, and we have settled on 2 different combinations that work from using day 2 through 11. So this was many plates, many incubators full of cells that took to finally settle on these components that finally worked. And then it still wasn't all that efficient, so we set about to see, are there any newer methods now that we could try testing? So we did come across this ReproRNA kit. We got really excited about it. It's only one vector where the Sendai is 3 that has to get into the cell in the correct ratios. So we were like, okay, let's try this. Well, it completely failed. We had no success whatsoever. We were very disappointed. And then I talked to my colleagues in Germany that are also working on rhino stem cells. And they were like, oh yeah, we tried that too. It didn't work for us either. I was like, oh, okay. Maybe we should have compared notes before we tried it. But we know this doesn't work. So we are going to continue to focus on using the Sendai for our reprogramming. And another busy slide. Basically, throughout all of those multiple reprogramming experiments, of those 12 cell lines that we have now reprogrammed 10 of those. One of them we just haven't tried yet because it's very valuable and I don't want to waste it in case the reprogramming doesn't work. And then another one has been completely resistant to reprogramming. She also happens to be the most genetically diverse. So hopefully we will get that to work now that we've identified these additional components. But we've been very successful in reprogramming them. We have several clones from everybody now, which is very important for the future applications because they can be very variable in their capabilities to differentiate in their pluripotency state. We've also reprogrammed 3 southern white rhinos because those are our reproductive model, so we want to be able to have those in the lab for comparative purposes. And then in addition to testing all of the optimizations for the reprogramming, we've also been testing multiple conditions for the cell culture media to help maintain that pluripotency. So we've had multiple different cell lines that will fail at some point. So we've been, you know, just slowly testing different components, and we've settled on a couple, and we have now updated our KB media from about 7 years ago to just last year to include some of those components. And here's what those cells look like. So here's the starting rhinofibroblasts. Here are our stem cell colonies on mouse irradiated mouse fibroblasts. And then we can also culture them without those mouse fibroblasts on a collagen matrix called Geltrex, and that's what's represented here. And basically what we have found is that the morphology of rhino stem cells is completely different than all of the other species that people have worked with. So you do not see the same morphology in human, you do not see the same morphology in mouse. So every species is a little bit different. Okay, so we've made all of these stem cells, but then we need to actually confirm that they're pluripotent. So I can look at them, I can know based on their morphology and how they're responding to the culture conditions and to the different experiments that we do that they're pluripotent. A reviewer is not going to agree with that. So we actually have to come up with a suite of methods to confirm pluripotency, which again, endangered species, whatever works in human and mouse is not guaranteed to work in rhino. So in standard protocol for human and mouse research, you use immunocytochemistry, you use a fluorescently tagged antibody for specific proteins for pluripotency, and you can then stain the cells to confirm that they are expressing that gene. So OCT4, SOX2, and NANOG are the kind of the core conserved pluripotency markers that we have seen across all endangered species, as well as human and mouse stem cells. So we had to screen a variety of different antibodies to confirm which ones actually worked in rhino. And then we have a couple others that we have used. And then we also use quantitative PCR. So we'll actually look at the number of gene transcripts that are present in the cells. And this is where our reference genome came in really handy the first time, was being able to use that to design primers for this. Because again, you work in human and mouse, you can just go to Thermo Fisher and order a set of TACMAN probes, and you can check your pluripotency. Well, we had to design 2, 3, 4 primer sets for our rhinos in order to come up with this suite of genes that will work in rhino. We also wanted to confirm that they were expressing these markers in the same fashion that the human stem cells would. So we were gifted a human stem cell line, and my colleague, Dr. Valiente, was able to stain the human stem cells, our northern white rhino stem cells, and our southern white rhino stem cells with OCT4, SOX2, and NANOG, those core pluripotency markers. And we do see conservation of the gene expression across all of those. We do have a drop-off in the NANOG within our rhino iPSCs, but that can happen because the NANOG expression does cycle throughout the process. So he took that a step further and actually did flow cytometry, where he can quantify the number of cells that are positive for each of those markers. And we do see a high conservation and high expression level across all three species. So human, northern, and southern are all 95 to 100% expressing. So we're pretty confident that they are accurately expressing these genes, markers of pluripotency. So we then wanted to do some more quantitative overarching work. So we did some RNA-seq. So we were looking at the complete transcriptomics of our cells. And so we were comparing our iPSCs to the parent fibroblasts. You can see that there's a lot of variability in the fibroblasts. That's to be expected. They were collected over many, many years from different biopsy sites, cultured in different media by different people. So we do expect to see a variety of gene expression profiles with them. But we do see that expression profile is consolidated within the iPSC, so they're much more similar, which is exactly what we want to see. And then we wanted to see how the northern whites and the southern whites compared, and we do see that the southern whites fall within the northern white population. So we do see some variability, but they do seem to be responding very similarly. And then we do have these two outliers over here. We think those are actually library errors, so those samples need to be rerun. So we're going to exclude those from the future experiments. And then we can also look at the top 10 differentially expressed genes that are in the iPSCs versus the fibroblasts, and we do see canonical markers of pluripotency over here. We have OCT4 and LIN28, and then we see things like collagen for the fibroblasts. So again, we're seeing what we expect to see in the expression profile of our iPSCs. So Inigo took it a step further and wanted to look at the metabolomics. So the first thing he wanted to do was quantify whether or not we had viable mitochondria in all of our cells. So again, comparing human, northern, and southern, and we do see high levels of viable mitochondria. And so he also did flow cytometry and quantified that. So we have over, I think, 99% of the cells are positive for viable mitochondria, and it's equal to the humans. So this is very important because mitochondria can help maintain the self-renewal and pluripotency states, as well as control differentiation of the stem cells. So this was a good sign that our cells are also responding in the same fashion as the human cells. So he went another step further and wanted to look at what types of energy production they were utilizing for their metabolism. And so we do see approximately equal levels of ATP and glycolysis. And he tested whether or not they were using oxidative phosphorylation, which this is the positive control here in green. So our cells are down here having a very low expression of that. And this is important that they are not using oxidative phosphorylation, but using glycolysis, because this supports some of our gene expression profiles and telling us that our cells are in the primed pluripotency state rather than the naive, which is where the mouse cells would fall. He also looked at some of the epigenomics. So we have levels of methylation and acetylation. So we have markers of, you know, differentiation markers being repressed and pluripotency markers being expressed, having active promoters. And again, we see equal levels of the cells from human, northern, and southern expressing both of those markers. And he also did immunocytochemistry with those markers, and we do see equal levels of expression across the methylation here and then the acetylation. And then, you know, he comes out to me. He's like, I don't understand, this one cell line looks a little bit different than the others. And I was like, well, which ones are you using? So this human line is a male cell line. This northern one was a male. The southern was a female. So you'll notice that we have these little foci of methylation. We actually think we've identified markers of female X inactivation within our cell lines. So this is also an indicator that our cells are in the primed pluripotency state because we have not reactivated the inactive X in the female line. Okay, so we have our iPSCs. We've confirmed that they're pluripotent. At least hopefully I've convinced you that they are. One of the things that does happen to stem cells in culture is that they can develop genetic instability. So you're artificially keeping these cells going in a cell culture plate in an incubator. They can, through multiple divisions, have problems with their genetics. So we wanted to look at that a little bit more closely. And our first indicator for that was that we were starting to see a little bit of a morphology change in a few of our cell lines when we would do this feeder-free adaptation. So when we remove those mouse embryonic fibroblasts, we switch from that KB media that we do the reprogramming in to this MTZR1. And we were coming up with these like centers of the colonies that would get this shadowy morphology. We're not really sure exactly what it is, but it was an indicator to us that these cell lines were not healthy. And so my colleague that did the genome assembly, he's also interested in cancer copy number variant. So he actually developed a pipeline that can quantify copy number variants within cell lines with Oxford Nanopore sequencing data. So he took our genomic data that we had from the fibroblasts from our reference genome and our stem cell line, that first stem cell line we generated from Angelifu, and he compared them with his pipeline. So this copy number pipeline is basically looking at the number of times that region appears in the sequencing data or doesn't appear in the sequencing data. And so what we found is that that first cell line that we generated from Angelifu has a large deletion in chromosome 5. So on the left of the chromosomes here, those are the fibroblasts, so the parent cell line that we started with. And then on the right is the iPSC line compared. And so where it is blue, that is where it is now only present in one copy and not in both copies of the chromosomes. So this is about 30 megabases and includes over 200 genes. Several of those genes are involved in meiosis, so gamete development and division, as well as tumor suppressor genes. So they have lost the ability to go through apoptosis when they have a change in their genetic structure. So this is concerning to us. This is something that we want to look further into. We have one other cell line that we have the same level of data from the Oxford Nanopore, also another male cell line. That one has a different change. That one actually has a trisomy on chromosome 17, which I did a quick gene search of about 10 or 15 genes. Every one of those genes hit chromosome 12 in human, which is a common trisomy that develops in human cell lines. So I'm expecting that this is a conserved mechanism between the two species, and I want to look at this further. So my hope is to develop some sort of quick and dirty lab technique with maybe quantitative PCR so that we can test these changes as they're developing through our culturing process. So we have our stem cells. Some of them are genetically unstable, some of them are not. We need to be able to test that as we go forward. But we're hoping that we'll be able to identify the causes of that and minimize that happening within our cell lines. So we have our pluripotent stem cells. One of the next tests for pluripotency is actually, can those cells differentiate into the three germ layers of the developing embryo? Or can they develop into other cell types? I have met somebody a few weeks ago that said they're not truly pluripotent unless they can make neural organoids. I don't have quite those standards, but if they can make gametes, I will be happy. So the first step that we did is what's called an embryoid body differentiation. So we allow those stem cells to aggregate together into just like clumps of cells. And we allow them to culture in suspension without the signals to maintain pluripotency. So we'll do that for a week in suspension, and then we will plate them for another week. So we'll give them 2 total weeks of differentiation time. And then we will examine those cells to see if we have markers of the three germ layers of the developing embryo. So mesoderm, endoderm, and ectoderm. And so again, we did a whole suite of testing with immunocytochemistry markers to come up with ones that worked correctly in rhino. And then we also developed quantitative PCR primers for all three markers. So they do successfully differentiate into embryoid bodies and develop all three germ layers. So that was great. The next thing we wanted to do was do a directed differentiation. And this was kind of twofold. Can it make the specific cell type that we want? But can a human protocol work in rhino? So we ordered a human cardiac differentiation kit, tried it on rhino. It worked almost exactly according to protocol. So we were really excited that we were able to generate beating cardiomyocytes in the lab with this human protocol, because that kind of confirmed to us that this early developmental process was highly conserved across these two very distant species, and that hopefully the research that was being done in mouse and human gametogenesis would then apply to rhino. So they can differentiate. I then got kind of sidetracked and was curious about our pluripotency state. So as I mentioned, our genetic markers, our metabolism is telling us that our cells are in a primed pluripotency state, which that means that they can only differentiate into those three germ layers that we just talked about. But what about the earlier states? So when you have mouse embryonic stem cells, they're over here in this more naive state. So they can develop into additional cell types. And as Fra mentioned, she's interested in placenta development. I'm interested in embryo development. So we kind of want to know what those earlier pluripotency states are capable of doing in rhinos. So we started looking at different protocols that have worked in human and mouse, different media components, testing all kinds of things. Basically, everything killed our rhino cells. So it was a little frustrating, which I have been told from multiple people that work on human that it's not easy to do in human either, but it was getting very frustrating. So we tested 3 different medias, and we decided to kind of focus more on this LCDM, which is like a formative or extended potential, so it has more embryonic development capabilities. And these are the cell types that have been used in bovine stem cell research that can actually make in vitro embryos. So we were gonna focus on this a little bit more and try and optimize this for rhinos. It worked once in one cell line, and then we tried it in a different cell line and it killed everything again, so we had to start over. So kind of like our norm, you know, our standard in the lab right now is they're not dead yet, because everything keeps changing as we're going forward. So we tried focusing a little bit more on this LCDM media, and so we kind of teased apart what were the components of this media, what could possibly be making the rhino cells mad. And so we started just supplementing the different components as we went to try and identify what combinations would work well in rhino. So we did a lot of testing, a lot of different combinations, and we kind of settled on a couple couple components that we liked. So we, instead of just throwing them into this completely different media, we started them in these basal medias with the same supplements that we use to maintain pluripotency in our normal stem cell media. And then we changed it to this formative media components. And so we have identified a couple components here that we think might work better in rhino. And so we are still testing it, because again, it does not translate well across different clones. But we are looking at the gene expression data now to see if any of these actually got us the correct pluripotency spectrum that we're looking for. So stay tuned for that one. And as I mentioned, I'm interested in vitro embryo modeling. So this is a relatively new field within the stem cell groups where you can take different combinations of pluripotent stem cells, let them self-organize in an aggregate, and they will actually develop in vitro embryos. So you'll get different components of the embryo that will develop. And this would be a way of studying embryos in endangered species, which we will never have embryos from endangered species to study. They are way too valuable as an organism for the future of the population than they are for research. So having these in vitro embryos that we can study will help us optimize culture conditions, cryopreservation methods, and actually study the development of the embryo in the lab. So this could help our genetic rescue process. And I'm really interested in this as well because they do spontaneously develop primordial germ cells. So those are those cells that we're trying to generate that will eventually become the gametes. The ones that develop in the mouse and human embryoids, they are actually more similar epigenetically and transcriptionally, so gene expression profile, epigenetic profile, to those that are actually derived from an embryo. So this will give us a better profile of what those primordial germ cells are supposed to look like. It might even provide us with a source of primordial germ cells. Okay, and again, this is Olive Fraw and Rubin's work, but they are interested in looking at trophectoderm differentiation. So this will actually feed into those in vitro embryo models, and they're interested in comparative placentation across species. So we have worked out where they're working with some of our rhino stem cells and testing different human differentiation protocols. And Rubin is pretty confident that the protocols have adapted to rhino because he is seeing conserved gene expression profiles within the rhino cells that he has differentiated. And I'm very interested in this research because implantation and development is one of the biggest things that's impacted by assisted reproduction technologies. So if we can improve the implantation when we can develop embryos in the lab, that will increase our success rate with bringing back the northern white rhino. Okay, so they can differentiate into all three germ layers. We've done directed differentiation with the cardiac differentiation. Can we now direct them into primordial germ cells? So this is our ultimate goal, is to get these germ cells that we can then mature into gametes. So the first thing we did, are our cells even competent to do that? So remember I said, you know, if they can't make a neural embryoid, then they're not pluripotent. For us, if they can't make a primordial germ cell, they're not pluripotent. So we took those embryoid bodies and we stained them for markers of primordial germ cells. We use markers that the human world is using and that also translate to primates. And so we have some flow cytometry data here where we quantified the number of cells that have TNAP and CD38 positive. And you see that it's very, very low percentage, you know, like 0.4, 0.5%, which may sound very little, but in a spontaneous embryoid body, you're only expecting 5% or less of the cells to make primordial germ cells. And the fact that these numbers are so low is telling us that these markers are specific for those primordial germ cells and not reacting with other cell types within the embryoid. So that was very promising data for us. We also stained them for PDPN and SOC17, which are conserved markers in human and cynomolgus monkey. And we do see that we have a few cells here that are dual stained for those. So we are confident that these, a handful of cells, are actually primordial germ cells. Well, having just a few primordial germ cells is not going to be enough to actually do any sort of genetic rescue. So we have been working on directed differentiation. So this is where you give the cells the signals to turn on the correct pathways to become the cell that you want. So this has been highly researched in mouse, and a lot of research is happening in humans because you want to look at, you know, reproduction for, you know, cancer survivors and things. You want to be able to help us reproduce if we are incapable. So we have been pulling from that research and applying that to rhinos. So the basic outline of the process is you take your stem cells, you do this pre-induction step, which is kind of like priming the cells to become primordial germ cells. So you're just kind of getting them in the right frame of mind to become a primordial germ cell. And then you do this aggregate culture, like the embryoid body, and give them the signals to make primordial germ cells. So again, all of the work started with mouse. So you take your naive embryonic or induced pluripotent stem cells, you do an epiblast-like pre-induction step. The components don't matter. What is important is that you're trying to replicate the area of the embryo that the primordial germ cells would be developing from and giving them the correct signals there. So in the mouse, they think it's coming from the epiblast. And so this is 48 hours of this pre-induction. And then you make the primordial germ cells in an aggregate and hope that they differentiate. So in humans, they think that the primordial germ cells are getting their signals from the early mesoderm. So we go through this incipient mesoderm-like state. So this is a slightly less time in this pre-induction state, but the actual signals required for making primordial germ cells is conserved. Well, we started working with the human protocol, and we were seeing a lot of luck with that. That was actually making primordial germ cells in rhino. And then just a couple of years ago, the group in Japan published a paper where they were actually using rhino embryonic stem cells from southern whites or induced pluripotent stem cells from one northern white. And what they identified was that this pre-induction step needed to be a lot shorter, and that instead of including the one of the key components for primordial germ cell signaling, BMP4, you actually needed to include that in this early pre-induction step. And then they swear that there's a difference between southern whites and northern whites. So they have a southern white protocol that they then applied to the northern whites, and it did not actually work in their northern whites. So they modified the protocol that they were doing for northern whites. I don't agree with this because they also said that the human protocol did not work in rhinos, which we have seen evidence that it works. So I think this is just a difference in the cells that they were working with, because they were working with embryonic stem cells for the southern white rhino, where they were working with iPSCs for the northern whites. And there can be a lot of variability within each clone of the cell lines that you're working with from each individual that can facilitate or inhibit their differentiation ability. So we wanted to look more closely at those differences. So we had a postdoc in our lab, Dr. Endo, and so he was comparing the rhino protocol and the human protocol, so the northern white protocol. He took 7 of our northern white rhinos and 3 of our southern white rhinos and did the protocol according to both of them. And what he found was that you see key upregulated genes vary between the two protocols, but that you see a high conservation of NANOS3, which is a gene that is only expressed in primordial germ cells. So this was really exciting that both protocols seem like they're working in rhino, but we do see variability in the rest of the genes. And again, I think that's more of the inter-individual variability than it has to do with the actual protocol. So identifying which protocol will pair with which cell line will be very important going forward. So we actually, that summer fellowship I mentioned earlier, we had a summer fellow last year that was actually a UCSD undergrad, and she was interested in looking at trying to optimize these differentiation protocols. And basically what she found was, we have more questions now than we do answers, but you know, that's how science goes. So she was interested in looking at this pre-induction step. Can I like optimize that? So you go from our standard substrate of Geltrex to fibronectin for this pre-induction step, so it's just a different attachment factor, which is a shock for the cells. So she wanted to see if having cell lines that were pre-adapted to that fibronectin would survive better. She wanted to see if you gave them an extra 24 hours before starting the process, if they would survive better. Because we do see 50 to 70% cell death as you go from your stem cells to this pre-induction step, and then you lose more cells as you go to the next step. We also wanted to check different apoptosis inhibitors to see if those would help prevent that cell death. And she was playing around with the different seeding densities to kind of offset that cell death in the pre-induction as well as the aggregate culture conditions. And so we have many, many, many more questions to continue fleshing out, but she did a lot of work, and I think there's a picture there of her with a stack of qPCR plates that was taller than her. So she did an awful lot of work last summer. Okay, so we can make primordial germ cells. It's not very efficient yet, so we still have a lot of work to do to try and optimize those protocols, but our cell lines are capable of making those. So the next step will be to actually take those primordial germ cells and be able to mature those into functional gametes that we can then use for genetic rescue. And this is something that has only been completely successful in mouse, of course, because, you know, mouse is our model organism. And so it's going to take a lot more work for us to get to this stage with rhinos. But basically what you do is you take those primordial germ cells, those aggregates that we just generated, you sort using markers for primordial germ cells, which we're still trying to optimize and find efficient ones that work really well in rhino and don't pick out other cell types. In the mouse world, what they do is they harvest embryonic gonadal tissue. So they'll take the ovaries and the testes from a specific stage mouse embryo, and they will isolate that material. And then you aggregate that with your primordial germ cells that you just sorted out. So they call this a reconstituted ovary or testes. So these cells are then responsible for giving the signals to those primordial germ cells to mature. And from that point, you can supplement the media with different hormone signals to then mature to a functional egg or sperm. So again, we will never have embryonic material from a northern white rhino. So it's way too valuable for embryo transfer to bring a new offspring. So we need to figure out how to differentiate our induced pluripotent stem cells to these aggregates, or to these somatic cells, to be able to make these aggregates. So that is a new process that we need to figure out. No one has been able to do that yet in rhino. They have some of the research figured out in human. So this is going to kind of be a holding point for us. But we were fortunate. So granulosa cells are the support cells for the oocyte maturation. Our reproductive sciences team was doing ovum pickups on some of our southern white rhino females, so harvesting oocytes from them for in vitro fertilization maturation. And so she collected these granulosa cells and shared them with me. So I was testing some different culture conditions and was able to actually cryopreserve some of these back. And my colleague in the repro team has done additional experiments looking at their gene expression profiles. So with this information, we are hoping that we'll be able to figure out which pathways need to be active in order to differentiate our stem cells into these cell types. So stay tuned for the gamete maturation. That's going to be a lot more work, and it will take several years before we get to the point where we will have functional gametes, but we are well on our way with this research. So our next steps for this are to improve the genome assembly and annotation. So as I said, it's a very high quality reference genome for an endangered species, but it's still just build one. We're on what, build 38 or 40 or something for human. So there's a lot more data that needs to be added in. And as we have found, so Yoshi and our collaborators here at UCSD have been working on some single cell RNA-seq analysis from those primordial germ cells, and we're having a very hard time aligning that data to the genome. So we do have to do a lot of improvements to the genome and the annotation in order to analyze that data. So that was a wake-up call for us of how much more work we have to do on that. And then, as I said, we don't actually have real reliable markers for primordial germ cells, so those cell surface markers that we can use to sort them out of the aggregates. So we're hoping that single cell data will also tell us what markers will work well for rhino and will give us a better comprehensive gene expression profile of what those cells look like. My dream is to have reporter lines where we can actually have fluorescently tagged cells in the lab where we can visually follow the differentiation process without having to kill the cells. So hopefully now with the reference genome, we can use CRISPR to generate those fluorescent cell lines. And as Megana was working on with her summer project last year, the primordial germ cell differentiation process is very inefficient. So we really want to optimize those protocols, test some additional protocols to increase our output of primordial germ cells. And as I said, there's a lot of variability between the cell lines in their ability to differentiate into primordial germ cells. And I firmly believe that is differences in their epigenetic state. And so I would really like to look at their epigenetic profile so that we can come up with a screening process to identify the cell lines that will efficiently make primordial germ cells so we don't have to waste our time testing all the different protocols. And I just want to touch a couple of slides here on what our future directions are. So we are expanding outside of the world of rhinos for the coming years. And I am soliciting help for doing some disease modeling. We do have diseases that are prevalent in animals under human care in zoos. So one of those examples is iron storage disease in black rhinos. Malaria and avian flu are very detrimental to a lot of our bird populations. And amyloidosis is a problem that affects a lot of the big cats that we have. So I believe we could have stem cell models in the lab that could help us look into these diseases and test treatments and find pathways that we can help modify these problems in these species. And then we also want to look at avian gonadal stem cells. So avian gametes are very different than mammalian gametes. So we have to come up with different methods for looking at that. And the next species that we actually want to start working on for the genetic rescue with the same process of in vitro gametogenesis is a Pacific pocket mouse. It's a native species. It's less than 10 grams. It's really tiny and adorable. So we are going to work on generating iPSCs from this species. And just to let you know, we've been doing a lot of black rhino reprogramming. It took additional optimization past what the northern white rhino required. They are only 5 million years diverged from the northern white rhino, so you would think it would apply pretty evenly, but it does not. We had to do a lot of additional testing. We had a lot of issues with maintaining pluripotent stability within our culture conditions, and so we had to identify additional components to include in our media, which we have included an inhibitor of the Wnt pathway within our media now, and we have just successfully in the last month and a half generated about 30 more clones from black rhinos that we've been working with that seem to be much more stable than what we had started with. And so stay tuned. We have a couple of images here, but we are still working on analyzing the data. So these are some examples of our feeder black rhinos. And then we have been able to adapt one cell line to the feeder-free condition, which is a problem, which hopefully this new stability that we have identified for the media for the black rhino will help facilitate this adaptation. But I am looking for new medias to test for the black rhino as well. And then we do have some NANOG and OCT4 staining. We just got these images this week, so there is a lot more data coming. And we just designed a bunch of quantitative PCR primers for them. And as I mentioned, we want to start going into avian gonadal stem cells. So within the bird world, you can isolate gonadal stem cells from adult testes, which is something that we have access to post-mortem from endangered species. So if we can sort those gonadal stem cells out and culture them, we would then potentially be able to revert them to primordial germ cells and transfer them to a sterile embryo to then generate, you know, sperm from an endangered species. So we have been just getting our feet wet with learning how to do culturing, which everything is in chicken, does not translate well to any other species. So we are working on testing culture conditions, and this is in collaboration with our reproductive sciences team, and we have several students from Cal State San Marcos that are working with us on this project. So we are very excited to hopefully be identifying some primordial germ cells. These are embryonic gonads from chicken, and then we'll be able to translate that to adult gonadal stem cell work. And that's it. So thank you for listening, and thanks to everyone who has made all of this research possible throughout the years. way too many to name.
Thank you, Marisa. There are people with mics, if you have any questions here in the audience first.
Hi, really beautiful work, like from thinking about the habitat of the rhino and then whether you can create these embryos or the gonads to be able to create the embryos in the lab. Like, it's been like a really, really big journey. I'm very interested in reproductive biology, and I have two main questions. So when you show the stem cells from the northern and south species of rhino compared with the human using the antibody staining, I noticed that the NANOG in the species of rhinos is very low. So do you think that this heterogeneity of NANOG expression in these species means that not all the cells that you have there are equally potent, that you have like a heterogeneous, like you're just starting with a very, like with a group of cells that don't have the same potency to be able to form the next cell types? And when you show the NANOG expression in the last black rhino species, the NANOG there is homogeneous, and then the colony looks like completely pluripotent compared to the other ones.
Yeah. So our first thought was that it was just that the NANOG was cycling, and that was why it wasn't staining as equally, because we do see relatively high gene expression with our qPCR and our RNA-seq data. So like the transcripts are there. My thought now is, after staining the black rhino, we actually switched antibodies. So we're using a different brand now. So I think this one is actually more affinitive to at least the black rhino. So we'll have to test it in the northerns as well and see if it works better.
And I have a second question, like, how far are you from obtaining the different types of pluripotent stem cells that are needed to generate the in vitro embryo models?
That's a great question. We had a really good run with a combination of the LCDM media with substituting out the B27, which I have firmly believed rhinos hate B27 since I started doing stem cells in rhinos. And unfortunately, the RNA samples were lost, so we weren't able to test those for the expression profile, and we have not rerun that experiment. But the morphology looked really good, and we did have a lot of cell growth. So I'm hoping, and we just need to replicate those. So we'll see, but it is very variable. Like I said, we had one, you know, like we would test it on one, it would look great. We'd thaw out four cell lines and test it again, and maybe like three would die and one would work. So we're still working on that. So maybe another year or two. There's only three of us, so it's kind of hard to get all these experiments done.
Related to what you just mentioned about how a protocol might look really great in one line and not work very well in others, we see the same thing with like human iPSCs. We have to adjust our protocol for every line. So are you hoping to find a unified protocol that a few different lines work with, or are you looking to do as many lines as possible and maybe each of them kind of have their own protocol?
Yeah, my pipe dream is to actually have one protocol that will work, but to have like an epigenetic and transcriptomic screening profile that we can test all of the cell lines first and then put them into the protocol. That's my hope, because then we can really fine tune that differentiation. But as you said, it's a standard problem in human iPSCs, and you can see from like 5 to 40% efficiency in generating primordial germ cells between different clones of the same individual. So I do think it's the pluripotency and the epigenetic state variability between the lines that's causing it.
And my other question is, are you hiring?
I wish. I would love to have more help.
Hi. Thank you so much for the awesome presentation. I had a question. So I think a lot of the early work in establishing the genome of the northern white was based on work that was done with horses beforehand. For the, I guess, the more like the future validation steps in establishing pluripotency and differentiation potential, were there similar studies done in horses, or has that just not progressed as far as, because you kind of looked at a human and mouse templates?
Yeah, the horse field, and I have not truly kept up on it, but they have still not published like reprogramming in Sendai, and most of the work that they're focused on is more like mesenchymal stem cell for regenerative medicine for the horses, because the racing industry and all of that is where the money is, and so that's what they're looking for, more veterinary applications for that. And so they have not been working on as much of this research. There's one paper out there where they have formative horse cell lines that supposedly made PGCs, but there has been no further publications on that work.
Thank you very much.
Well, if not, thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for coming. She's going to be around for a little bit if you want to ask questions.